This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
Ted Genoways joins me live in studio. He is the editor of the award-winning literary magazine, The Virginia Quarterly Review. How are you, sir?
I'm doing all right. Thanks for having me back.
I'm glad you're here. Absolutely. Been looking forward to it. I'm very glad you could join us. Now, it's been a while since you were here because you were on sabbatical. And you were, I would call over at the VQR and they would say, well, you know, Ted's not here. I'm like, what do you mean? He's the editor. You're doing a magazine. No. He's writing a book. He's on sabbatical. So give us all the details. What was going on?
This is like, I'm afraid it's turning into like one of the great boondoggles of all time. But it started as a single book about a missing period in the life of Walt Whitman.
And, wow, wonderful.
And so I wrote that book.
Which folks should know that in your grad school years, I mean, yeah. You are a Whitman expert.
I'm working on it anyway.
Absolutely, Ted, absolutely. Yeah. And you certainly know his work and his life much more than the rest of us.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's certainly an interest of mine and something that I've continued to pursue at the same time that I've been doing the work at VQR. And so I had this, what seemed like a nice, discrete project to work on, covering Whitman's life in the early years of the Civil War, because there's this sort of persistent myth that Whitman sort of vanishes for about 2.5 years at the beginning of the war. And it's just not true. There's a lot of information about him. It's just very piecemeal. And so I wrote that book and took Whitman from 1860 to the end of 1862. And that book's coming out in the summer from the University of California Press.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Very exciting.
You. But
another Whitman book. I'm already already reaching into my wallet.
Well, but the editor that I was working with there said, you know, you can't stop in 1862. You've still got years left before the end of the war. And I started to think that maybe there were additional things. I mean, most of what we know about Whitman and the war is in that 1863 to 65 period. But
he was what, in D.C.?
He was in D.C. Yeah. Most of that time.
Yeah.
And he was publishing a lot more and keeping diaries that have survived. And so that period is just much better known. And I guess I had hesitation at first about whether there was anything to add about that period. But when I got to looking at it and thinking about it, I thought, well, I think I can at least carry forward with the project that started in that first book. And so the plan is that this thing that I'm desperately trying to wrap up is the second volume of this two-volume set now. And then I'm also part of a team that just got a big grant to do a companion website for this two-volume monstrosity. So,
oh, wow. So there'll be a website to go with this book, Whitman During the Civil War.
Exactly.
Yeah,
and,
wow.
And the whole idea of the website is that all of the stuff that's mentioned in the book, any of the manuscripts, the letters, the diaries, anything that's briefly quoted, you can go to the website when it's completed and search and find the full documents. And,
oh, wow.
You know, see the original, see transcriptions and
that's fantastic.
Annotations. And so, yeah, it'll be great if it happens. Right now, it feels like the worst idea ever right
you
now.
You thought you were all done, and then those editors, I tell you.
Exactly.
Editors, man, they're always thinking.
Big idea.
They're always saying, hey, I got an idea. I want to bounce something off of you.
Right, yeah.
But no, it is very exciting, and you're the perfect person to do it. And that is, it actually is really exciting. What is it you think most people don't know about Walt Whitman, whether from that period or just generally speaking?
Well, I mean, I think we tend to have this sort of simple view of Whitman as he's often referred to as America's poet, and it's something that I actually use in the books to talk about. I think Whitman very much was America's poet, consciously trying to be the national poet, but I think he was just a lot more complex than people ordinarily ascribe to him. That there's this idea that, as I say, that this sort of simple narrative that during the early years of the war, he wasn't interested, he wasn't involved, and it was only when his brother was wounded that he became involved and went to the hospitals and spent the rest of the war in D.C. helping the soldiers.
It literally nursing injured troops, right?
Well, and that's the even that sort of thing. There's a sort of popular narrative there. I mean, Whitman spent a lot of time at the bedside of soldiers, but as far as actually as the myth goes, changing dressings and that sort of thing,
that's a myth.
Yeah, he was careful to be out of the room when they were doing amputations and stuff like that. And I don't blame him. But that's really what I'm trying to get at is that
the real story of
that it's much more complex.
Yeah.
And the thing that seemed eventually to be the sort of simple working method for me is that so much of what had been written about Whitman was based on things that he said about the war many years later. And what I've tried to do whenever possible and have been able to do about 90% of the time is to just rely on what material was available at that moment so that you're not getting his view from the 1870s of what things were like in 1863, but what was actually there in the notebooks, what he was observing, what he was writing, and how...
At the time.
Yes, and how confusing and uncertain it all was at the time.
What were his... We're talking with Ted Genoways of the Virginia Quarterly Review. He just wrapped up the first volume of a two-volume set about Walt Whitman during the Civil War. What was Whitman's thoughts about the war?
Well, they changed from month to month, from year to year. I think it's fair to say that certainly in 1861... when the war begins and before Bull Run, like many people, Whitman thought the war would be swift, it would be easy, and didn't give it a lot of thought. When Bull Run happens and it becomes apparent, especially as things stretch into the spring of 62, that this is going to take a long time, and his brother enlists, he, again... mirrors much of the rest of the country by becoming extremely patriotic, writing very what are referred to as the recruiting poems, trying to get people to go out and very pro-Union. And
almost like a Hollywood director during the World War II,
exactly.
Sort of rallying the country behind the cause.
And in that same way, I mean, he was writing poems to specific audiences, writing a poem for the Irish saying, you should enlist, that now that you've you've been given this place in this country, you should be part of this cause. And what interests me is that it starts earlier than I think is usually thought, that in 1862, in the spring, he starts visiting some of the hospitals in New York. And in talking to the soldiers there, he realizes how young they are, how inexperienced in some ways they are. But he also sees, for the first time, lots of people from different parts of the country. And he has the first, I think, full sense of what this nation is that he's been so in favor of and been, writing these poems, exulting. And in that recognition is both this sort of renewed commitment to the Union and I think for the first time, a more humanistic understanding of the toll.
Yeah,
that it's not just names in the newspaper, but men that he has sat with and talked with, and in some cases, passed all the way through a night while someone is sick or while someone is convalescing, and that then really really hits home with him in fall of 62. First as the whole country is shocked by the photographs that come out of Antietam, and the first time that we see the after effects of a battle. And then, as I mentioned, when his brother was wounded at Fredericksburg, and he doesn't just see it in photographs, he goes to the Fredericksburg battlefield looking for his brother
Oh,
and,
wow.
and finds you know, arriving days later, the carnage that's there and is going from makeshift hospital to hospital, looking for his brother and finding corpses on the ground, finding, you know, he mentions one particular tree where all of the amputated limbs are piled up.
My God.
And when he returns with his brother, who was only very slightly wounded, to D.C., he quickly decides, I'm not going to go back to New York. I'm going to stay here, and I'm going to work in the hospitals. He also takes a job with the government, just doing copy work. There were lots of official documents that were passing through the government, and he spent hours a day making handwritten copies. So, you know, no photocopiers at that point.
Yeah, yeah.
And which also, I think, gives him a fascinating view of things. He was working in the Paymaster General's office. And this is one of the things that, you know, I think the hospitals are incredibly important, but the Paymaster General's office was at the top of this gigantic old house. And Whitman talks about being able to look out the window and seeing the line of the wounded soldiers who are waiting to get up and be paid. And those of them that are on crutches have to climb these stairs all the way up to the top. And only to get there and be told, there's no money, we can't pay you anything, and have to go back down and are sort of milling around waiting. And this affects him incredibly deeply. And this is when he starts asking everyone he knows to send money so that he can distribute the money to the soldiers that he sees, that he can buy them food and tobacco and treats, whatever it is that he can do to sort of make things a little bit easier for them. And of course, at that time, he also starts writing for the northern newspapers and trying to spread the word about what he's seeing.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's and I mean, this is into the period where I'm languishing now. I'm trying to get this wrapped up. I mean,
it's an exciting project. It really is. Ted Genoways is the editor at the award-winning Virginia Quarterly Review, produced right here on the grounds at the University of Virginia. And he just completed the first volume of a two-volume set about Walt Whitman during the Civil War. Just one last question about this project, then we'll talk about the new VQR. But how do you personally, not as a Whitman scholar, but personally, how do you rank Whitman's work during the war relative to his full body of work? Was it just trying to rally people, or was he really creating some really important work?
Well, I my opinion is that Whitman had two really important periods, and the first can be sort of, I mean, it depends on how you classify it, but basically from 1855 to 1860, he published the first three editions of Leaves of Grass, and almost probably half of what we think of as the major poems were written in that time, maybe three quarters of them. The other period is during the war. We don't see the composition of the poems as clearly because of what was happening in the press, that poetry sort of fades from view as everyone is trying to focus on the news of the day. But when he publishes Drum Taps shortly after the end of the war, it appeared in May of 1865, so just really days after the end of the war and Lincoln's assassination. It was actually on press when Lincoln was assassinated. We have these poems of the war, and then he writes a sequel to Drum Taps. It's called Sequel. Those two pamphlets together are, I think, contain some poems that are certainly among Whitman's best. Probably the most obvious example is When Lilacs Last in the Dooryard Bloomed, the elegy for Lincoln.
Lincoln's assassination really touched him, definitely. Many, many people, but touched him in particular very personally.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I mean, it's hard for us to imagine now, but D.C. at the time was still sort of a small town, and it was Whitman lived and worked on 14th Street. You know, the White House, of course, is just over on 16th. He talks about seeing Lincoln on the street all the time, passing him as he was going out to the soldier's home. And Whitman actually got to be friends with John Hay, who was Lincoln's secretary and also wrote a number of speeches for Lincoln and that sort of thing. And so he was certainly not in the Lincoln inner circle, but he was on the periphery, and he had a great respect for Lincoln, in part because the same way that you see the respect that writers have right now for Obama, that there's this sense of what oratory can do and what good writing can do in bringing the country together. And Whitman really responded to what Lincoln was doing rhetorically as well as politically. And so to see that full movement and then for Lincoln to be assassinated, I think, you know, everyone, the whole country, as you say, was devastated. But I think Whitman saw it not only as this particular death, but saw it as this sort of tragic conclusion to the war, and as we saw historically that without Lincoln's powerful oratory and rhetoric, that the country really didn't come back together in the way that Whitman had hoped that it would.
Ted Genoways is the editor at the Virginia Quarterly Review, and he has just completed the first volume of a two-volume set about Walt Whitman during the Civil War. The first volume will be out this summer, University of California Press.
Yes, that's right.
Really exciting. It really is. And before we go to a break, I'm curious, in this first volume, was there one particular thing as you were working on the book that really jumped out at you, that may have surprised you, may have even surprised you as you worked on the in the volume, and you're laughing?
Yeah. Well, I know this is a family show, that's why I'm laughing. The thing that has probably made a few ripples in the Whitman circles for years, there's been an attempt to try to identify a woman who wrote a letter to Whitman in the spring of 1862 under a pseudonym. And based on what the content of the letter, it seemed that she and Whitman had some sort of intimate encounter the night before. And for those scholars who continue to try to deny that Whitman was gay, this letter has been really, really important as saying, well, you know, we don't know what this letter means, but it certainly seems that there was something very intimate here, and perhaps Whitman's sexuality was slippery in some way, and that we can't pin down. So because it was 62, right in the period that I was working on, I did my best to try to uncover what I could. And eventually, by combing through the newspapers at that time, found that this person had been arrested shortly after this letter had been written to Whitman, and it was actually part of a common scam that was being run at the time. And this woman turned out not to be a woman, but a cross-dressing man. And the trick was that this guy would have some sort of encounter with prominent men around New York in female guys, and then the next day would show up dressed as a man and demand blackmail money. And all we know is that one of these blackmail letters seems to have been sent to Whitman, and Whitman doesn't seem to have been concerned about about what this might have done to his reputation. And so it, instead of being the thing that holds out for the possibility of Whitman's heterosexuality, it seems to be sort of the nail in the coffin. So
this book, in terms of Whitman scholarship, your work here, this book is very, very important.
Yeah, there's new material here. That's the whole goal, is to not just be bringing everything together, but to be uncovering new stuff.
Very exciting. Ted Genoways is my guest for this hour on Charlottesville Right Now. We're going to take a break here at the bottom for local news and weather. When we get back, we'll talk about the new edition, the Winter 09 edition of the award-winning Virginia Quarterly Review. You're listening to Charlottesville Right Now. Let's rejoin our conversation with Ted Genoways, the editor of the award-winning Virginia Quarterly Review, and we'll turn our attention now to the winter issue. But before we do that, speaking of award-winning, the previous issue, it seems like you can't put out an issue of this thing, Ted, without winning an award. Congratulations again. The fall 08 issue.
That's right.
Was recognized nationally, right?
That's right. Yeah, the cover of that issue was chosen by Time Magazine as one of their top 10 covers of 2008.
That's fantastic. And that was one of Ashley Gilbertson's photographs, right?
That's right. It's that issue had a focus on vets returning from Iraq and Afghanistan, especially from Iraq. And the cover story by Gilbertson was about a vet who had served two tours and returned to his home in Minnesota and, haunted by memories of what he had seen and what he had done, committed suicide. And the cover photograph is that vet's sister who got a tattoo with her brother's face on her bicep with his birth and death date underneath. And that image is clear on the cover. And as she sort of recedes into a blur and shadow in the background. And for us, it just really crystallized this idea of how now only that death is clear in the family's minds, that their own lives seem to have sort of receded into this mist, while that death is tattooed onto them permanently. And I think it's one of the great untold stories of this war, that the number of vets who are committing suicide. And
I was going to say, actually, and that's one of the things we learned in that issue, is how high those numbers really are, startlingly, historically high, and how underreported, almost under the rug, this fact really is of all of these, mostly men, but men and women who are taking their own lives after coming home.
Yeah. The VA hasn't released hard numbers, but the estimates are that it's somewhere around 8,000 vets in 2008 alone that committed suicide, and that rate has been consistent for at least the last 3 years. And so, I mean, it's absolutely epidemic, but as you say, it hasn't really been adequately discussed anyway. And to me, the clear indicator is that everyone who sees this story, the question is always, where did you get these numbers? Are you sure this is right? And
I haven't seen this on CNN.
Exactly.
Fox isn't talking about this.
But everything that we've got is based on the government's own numbers. But it's using things that that come partly out of CBS's reporting with some internal documents that they obtained from the VA. But some of it is just from the National Death Index, where you can look and see how many people
all the veterans
are, you know, how many people fit a particular set of criteria, and the material's there, the information is there, and it's undeniable.
And at some point this country will reckon with truly what is going on now here and over there.
Yeah,
all the deaths, and right now we just don't seem to be as a country, we just don't seem to be talking about it, but it is going on, and all of these families are suffering in silence. You know,
that's the thing, is that I think, you know, the story about the Iraq War really shifted in this last year in a way that the discussion hasn't shifted yet. That everyone on the left has sort of had to acknowledge that progress is being made. That things seem to have stabilized in regions that we thought would never be stabilized.
Well, when you pay the people,
yeah, how lasting that is.
When you pay the people not to shoot you, that will have its effects.
and we had a great story by David J. Morris that started the year, where he went back to Ramadi and saw exactly that, and he's actually got a great picture of some Marines with stacks of American currency that they're handing over to the various local, militia leaders. And so, how lasting that piece is when the flow of cash stops, remains to be seen.
Yeah.
But the thing that hasn't happened is seeing, as I would expect, that folks on the right start to recognize also that as things are stabilizing there, that now is the time that we need to start very directly addressing the needs of the veterans and putting those resources as they're freed up toward the vets. And instead, it's really been an ignored issue. And I think it can't be for all kinds of reasons. I mean, the obvious reasons of you know, supporting the veterans and making sure that that's not just an empty slogan, but something that is an honest commitment. But also, just from an economic standpoint, you know, there are hundreds of thousands of vets now who are suffering from PTSD and from minor traumatic brain injuries, and those conditions are going to worsen if they're not treated, and it's going to be a drag on the economy, it's going to be a drag on the healthcare system, and they're not going to be productive members of society. And just from a really sort of cold economic standpoint, something needs to be done to help that group of people. And obviously then from a more humane standpoint, we owe it to them. They've made an incredible sacrifice, and that's got
Absolutely.
To be honored.
It's amazing how much things change and yet stay the same. I was just thinking about what you were saying in the last half hour about Walt Whitman sitting at the window looking out at all the veterans coming back from the Civil War injured, and you know, their government has nothing for them.
Exactly.
And here we are in 2009, and often that is the case. Ted Genoways is the editor of the Virginia Quarterly Review. And in the time that we have left, and I'm going to invite you, you, of course, are welcome in this room anytime, but I will invite you again to discuss in more detail the winter issue, because we were hoping to do that in this full hour, and now we have about 10 minutes left to do that. But tell us about the new issue of the Virginia Quarterly Review, which is out and available now, right?
It is. That's right. It's just out. The focus of the issue is on Cuba. We're focusing on it right now because today, in fact, is the 50th anniversary of Fidel Castro's arrival in Havana after the military victory had been secured.
Is this a big holiday in Cuba today?
You know, it's funny.
Are they celebrating this?
We had. You would think so. You know, even if it's a forced celebration, but we had
fireworks at gunpoint.
Yeah, one of our reporters who had one of the portfolio pieces for this issue went back down and has been posting from Cuba about what was happening in the days leading up to and the preparation and the actual anniversary, and it's all been kind of anticlimactic. I mean, she said that so much of the attention has been on cleanup after the hurricanes, and the Cuban economy is suffering just as much as other global economies, that there hasn't been much celebration at all there.
Interesting, interesting. But this is the 40th anniversary?
It's the 50th anniversary.
50th anniversary and of Fidel Castro's, I guess, official takeover
That's
of Cuba,
right? That's right. Yeah, and the lead piece in the issue by Neil Shea, a really fine writer and now coming to be a regular contributor to VQR, Neil went down to Cuba, spent a month there, and retraced Fidel's steps. I mean, he went to the spot where the little yacht that Fidel and some of his revolutionaries took it until it came into the tidal flats, and they had to get out and sort of wade through the muck coming ashore. Took that route that they took through the mountains and eventually into Havana. Talking to people along the way and trying to just get a sense of what people's notion of the nation was with this anniversary coming up, what their sense is of what's going to happen after Fidel dies. His health has been poor. He's extremely elderly. The country's bound to change. What do they think is going to happen? And it's very much a just a sort of a travel diary of what happens along the way, the people he meets, and yet strangely, the whole history of the country for the last 50 years is really contained in that story and in that trip.
Yeah, fantastic. And that's one of the new stories in the Virginia Quarterly Review, available now in the winter 2009 edition. We're talking with Ted Genoways, the editor of the award-winning VQR, which, by the way, folks, you can check it out online anytime at vqronline.org. And we will be giving away, thanks to Ted's generosity, a free copy of the new edition in just a few minutes. So keep listening. What else is in there?
Well, the second story is by Ligia Navarro, who had a great idea for a story looking at mental illness in Cuba. And the fascinating thing about this to me was that, you know, we hear a lot about how great the Cuban healthcare system is. The one hitch is that because of the Glorious Revolution, everyone is supposed to be happy. And so there is no depression. There is no mental illness as far as the government is concerned. And if the government is the only legal way you can get treatment for mental illness or depression, then you have to suffer untreated.
There's no treatment then.
And so what Ligia did was basically look at the underground, the black market in sedatives, that many of the people who, especially the people who are suffering from clinical depression, simply take heavy sedatives to keep themselves knocked out and in a kind of haze all of the time. And she follows the people who distribute and sell the drugs, the people who are buying them, and really gives this amazing portrait of what's happening there. And the other strange part of this is that the other thing that tends to happen, of course, is that there's an astronomical suicide rate relative to other countries in the New World. But those numbers may even be higher than the government admits, because they obviously have an interest in trying to keep those numbers down. And so anything that they can pass off as an accidental death or natural causes or anything like that, they do. And so as she's trying to talk to the government healthcare officials and everything, they keep insisting this doesn't happen.
Kill himself. He fell off a ladder.
That's right. People are so happy in Cuba. Why would anyone ever kill themselves?
And yet, it was reading on your website, yeah, it's got the highest rate of depression and suicide in the Western world.
It does.
That little island, that is just staggering.
Well, and I think, I mean, one of the things that Ligia does a nice job of getting at is that part of the problem is that with the embargo and the blockade, that there is no escape. And so if you are suffering from depression and you know that you have no chance ever of getting help, things tend to spiral fairly quickly.
Yeah.
That in some sense, the country itself does contribute to the problem.
What about what we call illegal drugs? I would imagine that is pretty big down there too as a result.
It is. But as I say, that it's because of how tightly controlled everything is, you can't get antidepressants, that sort of thing, but what you can get are sedatives. And so there's a huge black market in sedatives, but of course it's not treating the problem, it's just knocking people out.
Ted Genoways is the editor at the Virginia Quarterly Review, online at vqronline.org. And we got about a minute left. Is there one thing in there that if somebody's going to pick it up and you want to make sure that they check out?
Well, I guess I'll mention the third piece about Cuba that is a really nice personal piece by Paul Reyes. His father and uncle were exiled when they were small kids in the early 60s, and Paul talked them into going back to Cuba for the first time, and it's a really amazing and heartrending description of going back and this sort of melancholy of seeing this whole life that was ripped away from them when they were forced to leave the country.
The new edition of the Virginia Quarterly Review, which explores Cuba in the 50th anniversary of Fidel Castro's takeover and the ascendancy of communism in that country, is now available in local bookstores. You can get it online as well at vqronline.com. whitmanbook.org. Ted, thank you so much, and congratulations on the Whitman book.
Thank you, Coy. That's really exciting. As always, for having me.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit SeavillePodcast.com for more.